On this episode of Skeptico,
there are a lot of people scratching their head saying, what the heck is Jim Marrs doing getting in bed with these Scientologists?
Hey, I am not a Scientologist, and I'm not going to be a Scientologist. I get people all the time who say, will we ever know the truth about the Kennedy assassination? And I try to explain to them that that's not really what they're asking. What they're truly asking is, will there come a day when some government official will get up at a press conference before all of the mass media and say, okay, all right, here, we've lied to you for 70 years, but here's the real truth, and we're going to lay it all out here. And no, that ain't going to happen.
One thing that kind of irks me is the narrative that gets played out is, oh, this was all just kind of normal defense intelligence stuff. And, well, we had to do it because them darn Ruskies were doing it, and we had to have a leg up on them, which there is some truth to. I mean, clearly the Russians were involved in this. But it does seem also like we were using that as an excuse.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, that's a lot of facile rationalization. I think the reality of it was is the people who actually knew what was going on and saw the positive results from remote viewing, I mean, you know, who doesn't want somebody around who can tell them what's happening on the other side of the world?
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science and spirituality with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on today's episode, a personal hero of mine, investigative journalist, and multiple New York Times bestselling author, Jim Marrs, is joining us today. But first, a quick little anecdote about how this interview came about. You know, I receive a lot of pitches from publicists about new books that are coming out. And when I received one recently, I just read Jim Marrs on the title. I was like, oh, yeah, I'm going to do that. I love talking to Jim. He's always such a wealth of knowledge. And even though he's been at it for this long time and has written a ton of books, I think people sometimes forget how much knowledge he's continually assimilating into that head of his and spitting out in new and interesting ways. So I was willing to jump at the chance to interview Jim. But it wasn't until I had started booking the interview that I realized what I was getting into. And that is that Jim had been hired by Galaxy Press, publishers of Battlefield Earth, L. Ron Hubbard, you know, the Scientology folks. So when I looked a little bit further, I realized this had generated a little bit of a stir on the internet. Hey, what's Jim Marrs doing pushing Scientology books? And for me, for Skeptico, that's the kind of stuff I love to look into. So that's what led to today's interview with the one and only Jim Marrs. Today we welcome back to Skeptico award-winning journalist and multiple New York Times best-selling author, Jim Marrs. Jim, welcome back. Thanks so much for joining me.
Well, thank you. It's a distinct honor and pleasure to be here.
Oh, come on now. You know that's not true. But it is an honor for me to talk to you again. It's also a challenge because I have so many questions for you. I don't know how I'm going to be able to fit them in this time we have, but I'm going to do my best and jump right into it.
Well, answers are free. Now, I got to warn you, truthful answers are $5.
Yeah, I know how that goes. That'd actually be a bargain in this day and age, but
that's true.
Let's see. You know what I wanted to start with? It's a little bit outside, but I think it comes right back into your swing zone. There's a new movie out, Jim, Jackie, about the life of Jackie Kennedy. Have you had a chance to see it?
No, I have not.
You know what I thought was really interesting about the movie is it's all about her handling of the JFK assassination and how her decisions about that were really pivotal in shaping our understanding of that history. So, for example, she's wearing the blood-soaked dress after Kennedy is killed, and they're going, hey, you got to take that dress off. She goes, no, I want them to see what they did.
Notice. She said, I want them to see what they did.
And I'm going to get to that in a minute, because she also goes against everyone's decision to have a funeral procession that is directly modeled after Abraham Lincoln. She actually goes to the history books and wants to know exactly how they do it. She's insistent upon having her two kids walk out of the White House. And of course, these are the enduring memories that we really have of the Kennedy presidency. It's not of his policies or anything like that. So here's the thing. Here's the link, I think, to your work. Because the JFK conspiracy, that is the coup d'etat that you really were one of the people instrumental in unraveling and revealing, is as much a part of those images and those memories as anything else. I mean, no one looks at those pictures and says, oh, gee, that darn Lee Harvey Oswald fella, you know, I'm still so mad about that. What they think about is something went on there that is totally against our values, is totally against everything America stands for. Do you think we as a country are ready to accept that history, that alternative history that you've been so much a part of documenting?
Yes, I think so. I think we've all matured and we're more sophisticated and we understand. You know, you go back to John J. McCloy, who sat on the, well, he goes all the way back. In 1936, he sat with Hitler in his box at the 1936 Olympics and was a CEO of City National Bank, which is now Citicorp, and was the largest lender of money to Hitler and the Nazis. Okay, and then at the end of the war, somehow he becomes a high commissioner of Germany and was instrumental in bringing all these Nazis over here to the United States, where his protege, Alan Dulles, had become head of the CIA and whitewashed their pro-Nazi backgrounds and called them anti-Nazis and rolled them into our military-industrial complex. So he, early on in the war, and then he sits on the Warren Commission to determine what happened to Kennedy. And in one of the very early meetings, before they had really even gotten into a real investigation, he made the comment, he said, the most important thing is to show the world that America is not just a banana republic where the government can be changed by conspiracy. So, see, the whole position of the government early on was to not find the truth, not find out if Oswald did it alone, not find out who actually did it, but to simply show the world that America is not a banana republic. But unfortunately, I think if you go back and look at the assassinations of Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, the shooting of George Wallace, you know, the shooting of President Reagan, the Harvey and Oswald who were after Jimmy Carter, you know, then you find, wait a minute, we are just a banana republic. And so, yes, I think we're ready for this.
But Jim, I mean, there is a slight contradiction in that, right? Are we really ready, or are we ready to deal with it at a very kind of superficial, sweep it under the rug? I mean, what would it really mean to accept those truths that you're talking about? We accept it on one level because, like in the JFK movie, we say, yeah, we know that was a phony deal. But do we really accept it?
Well, we do, but from a dispassionate, unemotional, historical viewpoint. You know, yeah, that happened. Okay. And I hear people even today saying, like, well, so what? You know, what does that change? Well, you know, it changes everything if you truly understand that we had a coup d'etat in 1963, and this country has been on a downhill slide ever since. Now we got Trump, who says he's going to, you know, drain the swamp and make America great, and we'll see. We'll see if we can get back to the self-confident and productive society that we were prior to the Kennedy assassination. I wanted to mention, though, about Jackie Kennedy. Here's something interesting you may not have realized. She actually kind of is the one that really kind of broke up the conspiracy, caused a huge problem. Here's what I mean. On the flight back to Washington on Air Force One, initially they were saying they were going to take the body to Walter Reed Hospital. Well, that's the Army Hospital. And something tells me, and my suggestion is that they had their own doctors lined up at Walter Reed and their own handpicked people, and they were ready to take the body in there and do whatever necessary to come out with the result that they wanted, okay, which was to make sure that the wounds were reported so that it supported the lone assassin theory from with three shots from behind. But Jackie Kennedy said her husband had been in the Navy, and she wanted him taken to Bethesda Naval Hospital. And at the last minute, they had to change plans and shift to Bethesda. And at Bethesda, they had to round up those three inexperienced doctors and then put them under heavy manipulation and control by military officers so that the autopsy was shoddy and slipshod. And, you know, it was not carried out correctly, and there was a lot of questions about it, and that's what started the whole thing. That's what started everybody going, wait a minute, this doesn't match that, and that doesn't match this, and some. So you could actually thank Jackie Kennedy for shifting to Bethesda Naval Hospital, which caused problems all the way up to today in the medical evidence.
That is so fascinating. And, you know, those are the kind of little tidbits. I mean, you've been investigating the Kennedy assassination for a long time. Your book, Crossfire, which you're constantly updating, I give you a ton of credit for that. It's always new. It's always fresh, being re-released. But you've been at it a long time. I always wanted to ask you, what are one or two of the things that you yourself discovered and had that aha moment over the years where you just said, holy shit, what did I just run across, you know? Do you remember one or two things in that whole history that just really shook you?
There were so many. It kind of all blends together. But I guess my real epiphany came with, believe it or not, with Watergate, because Nixon was saying, I'm not a crook, you know, and I don't know what any of this is about. I'm not connected to this. And then all of a sudden, one of the Watergate burglars, you know, finally got up in front of the judge and says, okay, actually we're all working for the committee to reelect the president, or the acronym CREEP, which I love it. We're working for CREEP. And that was an epiphany for me. So I went, wait a minute. I said, because see, you got to understand that I was not satisfied with the lone assassin theory from that very weekend of the assassination, and that was simply because, as a grown man at the time, I was in college, I was a sophomore, and I had been deer hunting, and I had some bolt-action rifles of my own, and I grew up in Texas, we had guns, and we went out and shot guns, big deal. And when I heard all the witnesses saying there was a shot and a pause and then two shots right on top of each other, kind of a bang, bang, bang. Well, you know, and then they said, they were telling us that this had been achieved by Oswald with this cheap Italian war rifle, a Mannlicher Curcano bolt-action rifle. And I went, wait a minute. On a bolt-action rifle, you have to fire it, and then you have to cock the bolt, eject the empty shell, load the new shell, lower the bolt, regain your sight picture, and then fire again. You cannot get a bang bang with a bolt action rifle. And sure enough, buried in the Warren Commission report, even the FBI admitted it takes 2 seconds just to cock the bolt and pull the trigger. So, you know, there's no way you get a bang bang with a bolt action rifle. So I was suspicious and unsettled about the lone assassin theory from the very get-go. But then in the fall of 1972, when it came out that the Watergate burglars were working for Richard Nixon, that he had been lying about it, okay? And I just went, whoa, the President of the United States can and will lie to us. Well, then everything began to kind of come into place.
Isn't that interesting, just the change that we go through, you know, and what it takes to break down our pre-existing beliefs about how things are to get at the deeper truth of how they really are.
That's right. Well, and people do not realize what the tone of the nation was in 1963. This was just a whole different time and place. Everybody, and I mean everybody, had unlimited faith and confidence in the federal government. We were just coming off of World War II. We were the victors. We had saved the world for democracy, you know. We were God's gift to the world. And nobody would even consider the thought that maybe there was something wrong going on. And that's the same thing even with John F. Kennedy, even though I think there's evidence that he knew that he was up against some very powerful enemies and enemies that would resort to violence. Okay. He was fighting with the Federal Reserve. He's fighting with the CIA. He was fighting with the FBI. He's fighting with his military chiefs, the anti-Castro Cubans, the mafia, for God's sakes. Okay, so he knew he was up against some very powerful enemies, but he nevertheless was a part of that generation. He was a part. He had served in World War II, and I think even in the darkest suspicions of his mind, I don't think he truly believed that there would be somebody would try to undermine the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and create a coup d'etat in this country. And neither did anybody else, you know. It's taken 50 years of government lies and deceit and dissembling and bad actions for all of us thinking people to finally realize that, you know, the federal government is not the solution, it's the problem.
And I want to pick up on that because I think that's the current issue that's interesting today is, have we really picked up on that? And I love what you said earlier because I think it's spot on that we were okay with it as long as we don't have to really take it all the way in. If we can keep it at an arm's length and say, oh yeah, that probably happened. But I think there's like some deeper currents going on in our collective psychology. Back to the movies, you know, in 2013, I'm sure you know this, but Tom Hanks produced this movie, star-studded. I mean, Tom Hanks is about as big a Hollywood star as you can get. And he produced and starred in this movie called Parkland. And it tried to peddle the same old Lee. I don't know why. I don't know whose agenda this was to try and peddle this old story that Lee Harvey Oswald, lone nut assassin. But the bottom line is the thing flopped like you could never imagine a movie flopping. Less than $1 million at the box office. It's just forgotten. Is that also a message that maybe in that same way that people are saying, I don't really want to dig into it too deeply, but stop the BS, okay? I'm not listening to any of that stuff either.
I think that's it exactly. I think people respond to the truth. And this goes all the way back to my publishing of Crossfire. Back in the 80s, as we were approaching the 25th anniversary of the assassination, I was trying to peddle my book, Crossfire. I went to about 25 different publishers in New York and big publishers. And it's amazing because the basic argument I got was, no, we don't want this because, number one, we all know what happened in the assassination. You know, everything's been, that could be said about it's been said. And on top of that, nobody cares. And I knew that was wrong. And so sure enough, when my book finally was picked up by a third-rate publisher and published, it immediately went to the New York Times bestseller list. And within just a couple of months, I got a call from Oliver Stone wanting to know if he could use the rights for his film JFK, and there it went. Okay? So, see, I've known all along, people want to know the truth. But there is a tremendous control at the very top of the communications media because, like today, it's devolved down to about five giant multinational corporations that control everything we see and hear. And I'm not just talking about news. I'm talking about these five corporations control not only the broadcast networks, the channels, the TV channels, the cable, movies, books, magazines, billboards, all under the control of this handful of corporations that have interlocking ownership and directorship. So, you have a handful of people that basically are dictating what we see and hear. And for the bulk of the public who go to work, come home, sit down in front of the TV, watch their favorite channel, read their favorite big city newspaper, they think they're well informed. And they have no idea that that a handful of people that control these five corporations are dictating what they see and hear, and therefore controlling the whole dialogue. In other words, the media can't tell you how to think, but it can certainly tell you what to think about. And that's the way they operate.
Yeah, but Jim, you've been in the business for a long time now of trying to change and shift those paradigms and feed people different information. I'm wondering what you've found, what you've discovered about that process, because let's face it, it's not just about the data, the evidence. No one is reading Crossfire. No one's reading your 9/11 book, The Terror Conspiracy, and saying, gee, well, you know, that's a really good book, but he doesn't have quite enough evidence. There aren't quite, you know, the hundreds of footnotes he has aren't just quite enough. I need a couple more. What they're really saying is, I'm not sure I can handle this change in my belief system. I'm not sure I can really accept that new reality that you're talking about. How do people go through that, and what's it like for them?
Well, what I try to tell them is they're not asking, you know, I get people all the time who say, will we ever know the truth about the Kennedy assassination? And I try to explain to them that that's not really what they're asking. What they're truly asking is, will there come a day when some government official will get up at a press conference before all of the mass media and say, okay, all right, here, we've lied to you for 70 years, but here's the real truth, and we're going to lay it all out here. And no, that ain't going to happen, see, because of various reasons, of political pressures and pressure, peer pressure and everything else, but mostly because no politician, well, he's going to want to get up and admit to everybody that they've covered up the biggest murder in the history of this country, killed the commander-in-chief and the chief executive, and got away with it. Nobody's going to admit that. So here we are 52-3 years later, okay, and where we are is that anybody who can read and who can think realizes that it was not a lone assassin. There was probably a coup d'etat in this country in 1963, and we'll just move on from there. And that's why the Tom Hanks movie did not fare well, because people already know. So see, when they say, will we ever know the truth? We know the truth right now. It's just it's the difference. What they're asking is somebody going to get up and confirm that this is the truth? And no, it's not. But it'll just move on. And I've noticed that the change in the school textbooks, okay, in the few years after the assassination, most of the school textbooks says basically Kennedy was killed by Lee Harvey Oswald as he traveled through downtown Dallas, Texas, okay? And then all of a sudden, after the church committee, after the House Assassinations Committee and other things, and more evidence was coming out and more people were thinking, they begin to say, Kennedy was shot while driving in a motorcade in Dallas under controversial circumstances, okay? And then today, they just whittle it down, and most of the modern textbooks just say, he was shot while driving in a motorcade in Dallas, and a young Marine, Lee Harvey Oswald, was charged with the crime. And they let it go at that. They just do not get into the facts of the matter, which tend to show that Oswald was exactly what he said he was. He said, I'm just a patsy. I didn't shoot anybody. And apparently that's the truth, based on all of the information available.
Jim, in 2006, you wrote a book called The Terror Conspiracy about 9/11. Now, right. Just last month, we did in a show exploring the idea that the 9/11 truth movement, and I would amend that to include the JFK truth movement that you started back in the 70s and 80s, were decisive in this latest election and the defeat of the establishment, and that's what people were really expressing. They were expressing, hey, if there's someone up there saying that this rottenness that goes to the core can be changed, then I'm all over it. Do you think that that slow sea change that you were part of, JFK, 9/11, do you think that was really what voters were expressing, or are we kind of overstating that? Am I overstating that?
No, I don't think you're overstating it at all. In fact, I've tried to tell people I'm not sure we had an election here recently. What we had was a referendum. We had a referendum on the New World Order, okay? And basically, it's real simple. Are you going to vote for Hillary Clinton and continue the march down the road to social and economic socialism? Or are we going to put the brakes on and try to go back to the individual liberty and democracy that we've always enjoyed since the founding fathers broke away from England back in the 1700s? And and I think you can see that the results were quite obvious. What I'd also say is that people have now awakened to the misconduct of the major news organizations. The way they acted in this election is like, well, Hillary's going to get it. You know, why bother to go vote? Hillary's going to get it. We all know that. Look at our polls. We've got a poll here, so Hillary's going to get it. We got another poll, and all this was phony. All this was fudged, okay? And it really began to become aware to even the dullest person that the mass media in this country, at the very least, is out of touch with society and with the public. And at worst, they're just propaganda mouthpieces for the Democrats. And so I think there was a reaction to this, and I think we saw that reflected in the fact that and here's what's interesting. If you want to see what the vote was all about, Alex, picture a map of the United States with all the states, okay, and then see you've got your red states and your blue states, okay? Your blue states are the ones that were carried by the Democrats, and that includes California, Oregon, Washington on the West Coast, oddly enough, New Mexico in the middle, and then, of course, your New England states, Pennsylvania and Maine and Rhode Island and those up there, okay? Now, and Illinois, okay? Now, what's interesting is if you go and look at a map of that's into red and blue, the blue states being the states that do not require a picture ID to vote. And there they are, the blue states. And the red states do require proof that you're a citizen. Okay, so that tells you one thing. And then you look at the same map with the red and blue states, and you find out the blue states are the ones with the highest welfare populations. Well, see, that pretty well tells the story right there. You bring in immigrants who are illegal, who are not legal, and you allow them to vote, and you don't ask for a voter ID, and most of them are on welfare anyway, they are going to fulfill the what was said by the French philosopher de Tocqueville back at the time of the American Revolution. He went back to France and wrote a book, and in there he said, democracy sounds great, but it'll never work, because as soon as the public realizes they can vote themselves money from the public treasury, they'll just vote for whoever promises them the most. And that's where we are.
Jim, let's talk about the media, because you just brought it up. And in particular, let's talk about investigative journalism, which you've always been a part of and it built into your DNA, I suppose.
I think so.
In 2004, Gary Webb of the San Jose Mercury News, the guy who exposed the CIA's involvement in cocaine smuggling, was found dead, reported as a suicide, despite the fact that he had not one but two gunshot wounds to the head, and despite the fact that shortly before his death, he had told friends, hey, if you ever find me dead, it's not a suicide. So, we can add Gary Webb to the long list of suicided journalists who poke too far into stuff they're not supposed to do. Was there ever a time in your life when you feared that you would be suicided in that way?
Not really. As a young guy, when I had young kids in the family, I was a little concerned, for them. But after my daughters were up and grown, out of college and married and off, and, you know, I'm not so concerned about that anymore. And because my view is, what's the worst thing they can do to me? They can kill me, okay? If they kill me, is that going to be the end of everything? No, I'll just go do something different. Because, you know, we are, after all, energy beings. And as science tells us, you cannot create nor destroy energy. It's just there. It can only change form. So, I'll just change form.
I'm with you on that. How about this? Did anyone ever, you know, give you that little tap on the shoulder and say, hey, you might want to ease up on that one?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've had that. But then, in fact, I had a very prominent lawyer one time catch me on the streets of Fort Worth and say, maybe you shouldn't be writing about that Kennedy assassination. Says, you're upsetting some people at the Petroleum Club. And I just smiled and thanked him and thought to myself, well, too bad for them. They said, why is it that people in the Petroleum Club don't want the truth?
What about the misinformation game that goes on as well? Were you ever one of those guys who were led into a story that you later suspected that, you know, maybe there was another, maybe they were feeding you some stuff that they wanted you to put?
Yes, of course. In fact, I was, I've been in part of some stories where I think I was kind of set up, but I was young and inexperienced. And I think that I at least explains that, if not a defense. So that's just something that you have to do, you know. This is a problem right now. See, when I start off in the news business, there were always these old editors around, okay? And you'd come running in there, you know, and you'd say, oh, hey, I got a great story. I said, you know, the mayor just announced that they're going to build a great big, you know, housing division over here, and it's going to be a great boon for the city, you know. And the old editors would say, yeah, well, who's the contractor? Oh, Acme Construction. Did you know Acme Construction is owned by the mayor's son? You know, this is just a pork project, you know. That's how you learn things. And that's how you figured out how the world really worked. Well, see, today's they're not there. Excuse me. The old editors, you know, have either retired or died off and then went off. And then the new corporations that now run the news media, they're not interested in the news. They're not interested in the truth. They don't really want to know what's going on. They want to just have a healthy bottom line. So they hire young people. You know, one of the last books that I was publishing, my editor, the guy who's overseeing me and second-guessing me, was 23 years old.
Right, right. He's going to guide you, right? He's going to guide.
And he's going to guide me, right? And I get questions, queries from him, such as, and this is for true. He asked, what's a bank run?
Right.
He didn't know what a run on a bank was. You know, and this guy's editing me. But this in microcosm, that's exactly what's going on in the media today. And that's why nobody knows anything. Oh, they have pretty faces, and they've got nice demographics. You know, you're gonna have one fatherly looking white guy. You're gonna have one really pretty looking blonde tootie, and then you're gonna have a minority member. Okay, it's all set piece. There it is. But nobody pays attention to. Yeah, but do these people know anything? Are they journalists? Or are they just pretty faces?
Hey, Jim, in 2007, you published another book, Psy Spies, The True Story of American Psychic Warfare Program.
One of the most amazing books I ever got involved in.
Well, great. We're going to talk about that because it's a topic we've covered quite a bit on this show, including interviewing several of the people who were directly involved in Project Stargate for quite some time. I also interviewed Lloyd Auerbach about his book, ESP Wars East and West, that was co-authored by Dr. Ed May, who I'm actually scheduled to interview in the next couple of weeks. But Ed ran the psychic spying program for the U.S., and the book was interesting in that it also was co-authored by Victor Rubel, who was a high-ranking Russian official running the program for the Soviets. So there's a lot of history to unpack here, but what seems clear to me when the dust settles is that the quote-unquote psychic spying program was really a small component of a much larger mind control program that started decades earlier with Project Mockingbird, Project Artichoke, Project Artichoke. I gotta get this into the show so people, you know, one of the stated goals in the declassified documents that have come out of Project Artichoke was they had stated goals such as get control of an individual to the point where he will do our bidding against his will and even against fundamental laws of nature. So we, being the U.S. intelligence apparatus, were deeply, deeply, deeply into mind control. Wasn't that really the big picture? And isn't this whole Stargate thing just a small component of that?
Well, I don't know if it's a small component, but yes, you're right. It was a component, and it goes and it covers a lot of distinct things. For example, most of these people will talk to you about the remote viewing, but they really are a little hesitant to tell you about remote influencing. It's really pretty simple to understand how you could do this because, for example, you could take a rat, a lab rat, and hook electrodes to his brain and then put him in a cage with a cat. Well, he freaks out in fear, okay? And that registers as brainwave frequencies. And so they can take the same frequencies, turn around, and beam them to some other animal, including the human animal, and it could provoke fear in people. Now, it's not that clear cut. It's not going to just immediately, you're going to run screaming down the street. I interviewed a fellow one time who had been involved in that work, and he said actually they weren't really that satisfied with the results of their crowd control, mind control, not individuals, but as a group of people, a whole population. And he said, because number one, he said about a third of the people it just really doesn't work on. And he went into kind of a scientific, physiological explanation. But basically what he said was is that to alter someone's thinking, first they have to be thinking. And you got about a third of the population. They get up, they go to work, they come home, they drink a beer, they watch TV, they go to bed. They're not really thinking, so it doesn't really affect them. Now, another third of the population would probably include you and I and hopefully all your listeners. And these are people who, yes, it would influence, but not to the point to where it couldn't be overcome by their own self-esteem and their own identity. In other words, and, you know, think about it. I mean, how many times have you woke up in the morning and you go, oh, man, I just don't want to get out of bed. But then you go, oh, well, I got stuff to do. I got meetings. I got to do this. I got to do that. And boom, you're up and you're going, you know, so you overcome it. So he said only about a third of the population does this mind control actually work on. And he said, but this is the dangerous ones because these are the ones who are the borderline schizophrenic, borderline psychotic. And sometimes this remote influencing, this mind control, this, using frequencies, electromagnetic brain frequencies, that it can push them right over the edge. So, and if you think about it, it's only been in recent years. I know when I was a young kid, we never heard anything about school shootings. Or, you know, I guess the first one I can recall was... I can't remember his name now, but the tower shooter at the University of Texas in Austin. But up until then, there didn't be anybody walking in places, shooting up places or anything. And so, what we're seeing are the effects of the surreptitious mind control experiments that we were brought over here from the Nazi scientists, rolled into the CIA and the military, and they continued their work. Now, remote viewing is a whole different thing. Remote viewing, if it's done properly, you just go out and you view something. You look at it. In fact, it's interesting that they were talking about the differences between channeling and remote viewing. Remote viewing is when you cast your mind out there as an objective observer, and you're just kind of looking at whatever's out there, whether it's on this earth or outside this earth. Channeling, on the other hand, is when you open yourself up to any entity that might want to come and come into your body, come into your mind, you know. And they said that can be a little hazardous because there's no guarantee when you open yourself up and ask for some being to come to you, that there's no guarantee who you're going to get, you know.
And expanding on that a little bit, we don't know what they know in terms of dabbling into those realms. One thing that kind of irks me is the narrative that gets played out is, oh, this was all just kind of normal defense intelligence stuff. And, well, we had to do it because them darn Ruskies were doing it, and we had to have a leg up on them, which there is some truth to. I mean, clearly the Russians were involved in this. But it does seem also like we were using that as an excuse. Richard Helms, director of the CIA and father of the MK Ultra program, you know, contradicts himself over and over again to Congress. At one point, he's saying, well, you know, we really have to work on this because the Russians are way out ahead. And then the next time he comes back, he says, well, you know, they don't really know what they're doing. We're 5 years ahead of them. I mean, it sounds like what they were trying to do was weaponize not only the psychic aspect of it, but as you alluded to, the magical, esoteric, otherworldly, demonic, they didn't care what it was. And from an intelligence standpoint, you can understand it. If there's demons out there, well, let's figure out if they're a security risk, number one. And then number two, if we can get them on our side, well, then that's great. Let's use them.
We use them as a weapon. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, that's a lot of facile rationalization. I think the reality of it was the people who actually knew what was going on and saw the positive results from remote viewing. I mean, you know, who doesn't want somebody around who can tell them what's happening on the other side of the world, you know, without the use of the normal five senses? And so the people who knew that it was working, they, as you said, they wanted it, and they wanted to weaponize it. They wanted to keep it to ourselves. And as a result, they came out with all kinds of facile explanations about why we need to be doing this. But the reality of it was we need to be doing this because we could, and they wanted to find out where it led. And, you know, this is what got me going with remote viewing, is that early on when I first heard about that, back in probably the late 80s, early 90s, and it was still a very top secret classified program. And as a journalist, I thought, wow, what a story, okay? I said, because it's either true or it's not true. And if it's not true, then here's a great story about a waste of taxpayer money by funding all of these experiments and funding this work through the CIA and through the Office of Naval Intelligence and on up through the work done at Stanford Research Institute out in California, and then all the way into forming a unit within the United States Army of these psychic warriors, you know. I said, oh, what a story. And I said, but then on the other hand, if it turns out it is true, holy cow, you know, this is an evolutionary leap for mankind. And it turned out it is true. And I know this because I studied it at length. I interviewed and talked to most of the
You actually tried it, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. And then I've done it myself. Yeah. And in fact, the very first time my first effort at remote viewing, I drew a floor plan for a office building that was 100% accurate, and the thing hadn't even been built yet. I was looking into the future. But then a year later, when I went to Albuquerque, and I went to this place, I'm going, holy cow, that's kind of how I envisioned it. And they gave me the official floor plan for this place, and it was 100% accurate from what I'd drawn the year before.
You know, one other thing I've learned, and I want to bounce this off you because it relates back to this very interview, is that, and a lot of people don't know this, but Dr. Hal Puthoff, who along with Russell Targ were both top-notch scientists before they got involved with the remote viewing Stargate program. But anyways, Putoff was a Scientologist, quite an advanced Scientologist, as was Ingo Swann, the psychic who really kind of started the whole program. He was a very advanced Scientologist, but the real story is that that wasn't an accident, because U.S. intelligence apparatus had hotly pursued Scientologists, had hotly pursued L. Ron Hubbard for years, because, of course, L. Ron Hubbard was Navy intelligence, and he had gone off, and he was doing this mind control thing that he wrapped into the Scientology thing. But they wanted to know, hey, has this guy figured out something that we need to have? And they were hounding him and trying to infiltrate him and get that. So what do you make of that whole Scientology MK Ultra project connection and that battle that was going on there? Have you looked into that?
Well, yes, I have. And basically, I think that they were kind of running in parallel in their research of the mind and how it all fits together. And I think for Hubbard, that led to his advances in what he calls Scientology. They were anxious to know what he was doing, and there was that overlapping connection. Now, L. Ron Hubbard was quite a guy. He was, I knew him as a science fiction writer, okay, before I'd ever heard of any of Scientology. And he was actually quite famous in his time, and back in the 40s and 50s, he was well known, and he was right up there with some of the giants in the field of science fiction, like Arthur C. Clarke and Ray Bradbury and Isaac Asimov. And it's useful to go back and read some of the stuff he's written. Of course, through the 30s and 40s, he was writing pulp fiction. But as such, and as a world traveler, he really had this broad view of an insight into the world and to the various nations and how things were fitting together. And I think that that made him very desirable. And you're right. They also, back at this time when Scientology first got going, they were kind of at loggerheads with the federal government because they were finding out, they were infiltrating government offices, and they were revealing some of the corruption that was going on within the government, and the government was coming down on them. But then at some point, some kind of agreement was reached. They were granted a tax-exempt status as a church, and they dropped their lawsuits against the federal government, and they've been, everything's been copacetic ever since.
But boy, I don't know about that. There's a long history of battling back and forth. I mean, they give them the tax-exempt status, but later on they take it away. L. Ron Hubbard is writing and saying we cannot let this technology get in the hands of people who want to weaponize it inside the government. But in the meantime, he's doing some really crazy thing. He's out there with, you know, Aleister Crowley proteges and trying to summon demons. He's trying to play the magic game too. I mean, there's a lot of crazy, crazy stuff that seems extremely well documented, but there is this back and forth all about mind control between the Scientology people and the military intelligence people. And what a lot of people think is that eventually, and I don't know if you have an opinion on this, but eventually the military intelligence people kind of won out and did infiltrate Scientology and did take it more in a direction that they wanted to explore, or at least tried to siphon off any technology on that.
Well, they of course came up with their Stargate program. And they were the ones that were doing their own. And I think a lot of this may have been, now there may have been some overlaps, and I'm sure they wanted to know what Hubbard knew. But I think that they were just kind of running parallel in their investigations. But I think you're right. I think that the military-industrial complex kind of came out on top. This is why I like today. If you ask them, is there a remote viewing unit within the U.S. Army? They're going to just say no. Okay,
right.
And technically that's true, but what they've done is instead of having one unit where they put all their psychic spies into, they're spread out and they are embedded and a lot of these different things, like Navy SEALs and Army Rangers. You know, I mean, what commander would not like somebody at hand who might can tell him what's on the other side of the hill? And so they're still using it, but they're using it in a diffused manner. But you can actually learn a lot from reading Hubbard's works. Battlefield Earth is they've just issued in a new edition last year, and you can get really good deals on that at Amazon, and you can go to their website, battlefieldearth.com. But what's cool is here's a story of an alien invasion, but yet it's not like what we see today, like in Independence Day, where the aliens just come and want to blow up everything. This is the intergalactic bankers have loaned money to the Intergalactic Mining Corporation, giving them a contract to loot the mineral resources of the Earth. But they have a timetable. They're supposed to complete it in such a time, and they're beginning to push on this timetable, and they're getting worried because these pesky humans are causing problems. So they've got to go into the planet Cyclos and get these tall, hairy aliens to come and try to subdue the pesky humans on the Earth. And anyway, it's all a big business deal. It's just a deal, you know, which is really interesting, because when you look at the United States today and what we're doing in other countries trying to get their mineral resources and claiming we're bringing them democracy as we bomb the hell out of them, you know, it kind of runs parallel there. It's kind of like, yeah, you know, I think he had a kind of a vision of how things were going.
That's a great point, and one of the points I wanted to talk about. I don't know how you feel about it, but, you know, one of the reasons that you're here today is that the publicist for Galaxy Books, the Scientologists who own Battlefield Earth, contacted me and said, hey, Jim's out here and he's promoting our book. Now, I got to tell you, and you know this, there are a lot of people scratching their head saying, what the heck is Jim Mars doing getting in bed with these Scientologists? What do you say to that? There's a lot to sort out there before we can really talk about Battlefield Earth. I mean, to heck with that. Yeah. We got this huge Scientology thing to deal with.
Hey, I am not a Scientologist, and I'm not going to be a Scientologist. And the only reason I'm...
Do you think they get a bad rap? Earth. Do you think the Scientologists get a bad rap?
In many areas, I think so. I do. For example, there was a big documentary on recently. What did it call it? I think it's called Getting Clear. Okay, and their big thing was because of the e-machines, and you're supposed to clear your aura, or I don't know what all, whatever all that is. See, the only reason that I'm touting for Battlefield Earth is that I read it when it first came out, and I was a big fan of L. Ron Hubbard, and I just think it's a great book, and I think there's some parallels with today's society. I don't know. I guess it's just like, Alex, if you found a particular brand of beer that you thought was really great, you go to your friends and say, hey, try Schmidt's beer. You know, it's great.
Unless ISIS was brewing it and distributing it, then I'd say, you know what? It's the best damn beer I've ever had, but I can't.
Yeah, you may have to pull up there, but I know. Listen, this is... Scientology is kind of just like anything else. You can go to any other religion. Well, listen, you know, start to say, take the Catholics. They've had their share of bad press, right?
Sure.
Okay. And if you go to any other religion, Baptist or any others, you're going to find disgruntled members. You're going to find corruption. You're going to find some bad things going on. Anytime you get a whole group of people together, you know, there's always 2% that's going to cause trouble. And so I'm not trying to say that everything's fine. I don't really even know, and I don't particularly care as long as they're not in my face and bugging me. And then the people I've met and dealt with within Scientology have always been wonderful people, and they act in a very positive and Christian-like manner. You know, they might cringe at my saying that, but it's true. They are very alert, very smart people, very educated people, very thoughtful people. At least that's the ones I run into. And of course, I can't speak for all of them, and I'm certainly not because I'm not a Scientologist, and I don't plan on being one.
What about the allegations of people like Jenna Hill, a real credible Scientology insider who says, you know, the kind of mass child abuse, mind control stuff that goes on in there is just the kind of horrific things that we would never hear about, but that we, when people do break away, they say this is purely a cult.
Well, I you know, like I said, I can't say it doesn't happen. I haven't had any. All I can talk is from my experience. And it's like, for example, when they refer to the church, and a lot of people think that that's a, you know, cultist thing. You're with the church or you're against the church. And I had them explain to me. They say, look, you don't understand. The definition of a church is simply the gathering of people with a common interest and thoughts. And that's what we do. So, you know, it's I don't know. Believe me, you could go to any particular church in this country, and I'll bet you could find somebody who says, well, that's a cult. They just go down there, and they all talk about so-and-so, and they gossip against each other, you know. So I'm not trying, I can't defend, I'm only trying to explain that, it obviously for the handful who say it's a cult and have raised questions about it, then you've got, you know, thousands that are members that seem to be pretty complacent with it. I don't know. But I just that's for everybody else to decide for themselves and what their understanding is based on their experience. But like I said, based on my experience, everybody I've ever met that has anything to do with Scientology are just really kind of nice, good people. So I don't know.
Jim, what else are you working on these days? What's the current book?
Well, I'm working on a book right now that I think you're going to really like if they keep the title. Right now I'm calling it Shadow of the Illuminati. And the basic idea is the old German Order of the Illuminati, you know, was outlawed and disbanded, and that seems to be true. But the theology of the Illuminati, or Illuminism, as I call it, is another ism, okay? Just like Nazism and fascism and communism and feminism and all of the environmentalism, all of the isms, it's another ism, and it is still in practice today. And the key component of the Illuminati theology is the idea that the end justifies the means.
Right.
And we've seen that in action with the communists in Russia. We've seen it in action with the National Socialist in Germany. We've seen it in action in our own country. In fact, I say that if you could empty the pockets of Dick Cheney and Hillary Clinton, you're not going to find a membership card to the Illuminati. And yet both of those individuals practice Illuminati theology.
And what's going on at jimmars.com? One of the things I love about jimmars.com, and a lot of people might not know this, but you release a ton of information beyond these books. So you're constantly commenting and writing posts and updating people on current events and things that are going on. So, yeah. You know, tell folks what they can find there as well.
Well, for one thing, I know at one of my books, I was told by the publishers that I had to delete a whole section. And I said, well, I don't think so. I think this is
because you've given out too much. Is that what they said? You've kind of given out too much on the website?
Yeah. Well, they said, no. They just flatly said, if you don't take this out, we won't publish the book. And, of course, what's interesting is the section they wanted me to take out was the section on how the corporations control the media.
Oh.
And so I said, well, you kind of proved my point, didn't you? And so I immediately, of course, took the whole censored portion and posted it on my website, jimmars.com. And I said, here's what they censored out of the book. And so it did get out to a more limited extent. So there's lots of stuff there. Yeah, I publish. Not only can you get my books and DVDs, but you can get I post stories that you may not find in the mainstream media. So I would advise people to go visit me at jimmorris.com. And as one national radio talk show host said, and I had to stop and think about this, he said, if you'll read all of Jim Morris's books, you will have the equivalent of a college education.
And you won't have to rack up all those student loans either, will you?
That's right. That's right. Just the cost, just the cost of a book, and you're there.
Well, Jim, it's been fantastic having you on. Best of luck with all these projects you're working on. Certainly hope we can talk again when the next book comes out. Thanks again so much for joining me.
That would be fun. I look forward to it, Alex. Thank you.
Thanks again to Jim Morris for joining me today on Skeptico. I have a bunch of questions to tee up from this interview, but I'm going to limit it to one because this connection between Scientology and the longstanding interest our United States intelligence organizations have had in the mind, the power of the mind, mind control, uses of extended consciousness. That's a topic that comes up not only in this interview, but in the next interview in a very interesting way as well. So the question is, what do you make of that connection? The connection specifically between Scientology and what military intelligence was doing in looking into the mind. I've partially investigated this, but I guess I'm throwing it out there because I'd love to get other people who've maybe looked into it more or are willing to look into it more and dig up some more information, because I think there's quite a story here and one that hasn't been fully explored. So if you'd like to join in this conversation, of course, the place to do it is over through the Skeptico website, and in particular, at the Skeptico Forum. The website is skeptiko.com. And from there, you can jump on over to the forum. You can also download all these shows for free. And hey, by the way, when you jump on over to the forum and you sign up, and you'll have to send me an email, and then I'll say, wow, great, thanks for joining us, which I love to do. I love to connect with people and really hear what they're about before they join the forum, but that's just a cool part of the process. But once you're there, please do me a favor and say hi and say thanks to David Bailey, one of the forum moderators who's really done a great job over the last year plus in moderating our forum. And he doesn't nearly get enough credit for this thankless job that can only bring you grief. You know, you're a moderator for a forum. No one likes the moderation. Or I should say, there's always people who don't like the moderation. So it's kind of a thankless job, and I'm really appreciative that David has stepped in there and done such a great job with it. Of course, if you're not into forums, you can send me an email directly or contact me through Facebook or any other way. I try and stay on top of that, but I'm really more of a regular on staying on top of the forum, because you wind up just having one place where you can go to and kind of get your ideas out there. But that's just my style at the moment. Anyways, I have a number of these interesting shows coming up. They're piling them up. A couple of them have gotten quite contentious. I'm sure you won't find any surprise there. I don't know what it is. I don't know why people don't like my questions. I got some ideas, but I'm going to keep asking them anyway. So once again, that's it for this episode. Until next time, do take care and bye for now.